seen it because it seems. Tim Hopkins, and this is Freaky Trigger and the Lollards of Pop. We're just poking our wrinkled little noses into the afternoon of Sunday, April the 1st, and it's the beginning of a whole new Resonance FM 104.4 broadcast day. Blessedly, the lame-o April Fool's jokes are over for another year, and anyone who even mentions them again gets a special pinch and a punch from us, with no returns. Your Lollards this week are Katie Grocott, the Queen of Bass Frequencies, Magnus Anderson, and first-time Lollard, Emma Hamilton. Say hello, Emma.
Hello.
Dread at the controls is Mark Sinker.
Hello.
What's ahead on the show? We'll be thinking of our childhood heroes and how they're reimagined and reinvented in an attempt to bring them up to date for the poor souls who have the misfortune to be the youth of today in it. We'll be making like Annika Rice, or actually probably more like Mike Smith, and taking a helicopter view of the short and variously glorious history of spoof reality TV shows. We'll be treated to another visit from the Claire Rayner of Pop Chat, our resident music counsellor and sympathist, Tanya Heedon. And since half of the Freaky Trigger team seem to be in the process of mothering or fathering children just now, we'll be talking about the pitfalls and possibilities of naming the little blighters. All this, plus our pop picks, before we exclusively reveal the new worldwide number one hit single, as judged by that most demanding of audiences, you, the illegal toploader. Sorry, downloader. This week, we're coming to you live from the august surroundings of the virtual Glastonbury booking office, which is on the planet Cybertron, where we can see all manner of e-hippies and i-no-marks with their virtual faces pressed up against the virtual glass. We wish they'd go away. Before all that, though, what's gone before? Nonsense, when all is said and done, is still nonsense. But the study of nonsense, well, that is science. Freaky Trigger, the internet's only marginally sane collective, drops science like it's hot, so you can pick it up again. Our results are naturally verifiable and published in the Learned Journal, which you can find for free and on the internets just by typing freakytrigger.co.uk into one of those computing devices you all seem to love so much. So, in spring, a young website's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of love. In our case, this means kicking off a whole new doomed project, the periodic table of Freaky Trigger. It began with atomic number one, and that was love. Aww. Love is contagious, and it's all around. But it's not a stranger, and it's definitely not in an open car. Anyway, less love this week. Less love this week in the comments boxes of popular Tom Ewing's quest to review every UK number one single in order. Tom Savage, the mild-mannered Vincent by Don McLean off Crackerjack, giving it 1 out of 10. It's the lowest mark Tom's given so far, and one or two people weren't very impressed. For myself, I thought Tom was unnecessarily generous. Oh. Our collective minds were also boggled by a Radio Times poll. Radio Times readers apparently think the coolest man on telly is David Tennant's Doctor Who. But also the top 10 includes Jack Bauer off of 24, Dylan off The Magic Roundabout, and The Cat off of Red Dwarf. That's The Cat off of Red Dwarf, being one of the coolest men on telly.
Even though he's a cat.
Even though he's
Dylan is a rabbit.
Indeed. Yeah, well, quite.
But those are protest votes.
Are they, Mark?
They're people undermining the concept of cool.
Are they?
They're culture jammers.
Well, apparently Radio Times' equation of cool is sexy plus laid back. Laid back like Jack Bauer, right? Makes no sense. So this has to be bad science somewhere along the line. And it's easy for us to criticise, but the question that we're faced with, if we are going to get snippy about it, is who should have been on the list? Magnus?
Well, for me, there was an obvious missing candidate on this. He's not a fictional character, but then neither's Dermot O'Leary, as far as I know.
Completely fictional, but with a lovely hair.
My choice is the notoriously, allegedly bejewelled economics commentator from the BBC, and that's Evan Davis.
Oh, lovely Evan.
Apparently a lovely man.
Absolutely. I've not heard a bad word about him, even from people who are forced to work for him every day. And he once came and spoke at an industry gathering. I work in a very esoteric industry. And we're normally used to people making jokes about how little they know about what we're talking about. And Evan Davis turned up, and he gave us a speech which not only was very informed and erudite, it actually told us things we didn't know. He would have been a top analyst in our industry, in our tiny industry. And yet, he's just wasted on BBC commentary.
I'm a bit upset at the idea that there's something you don't know, mate. Katie, do you have any picks for the coolest man of the...
Well,
on telly?
I was thinking I was going to nominate Adam Hart-Davis, because he loves his stuff. But sitting here, I'm actually going to nominate Phil out of Time Team, because he is the most laid-back man on telly. He kind of digs stuff up and everyone else gets really excited, and he clearly just wants to be at the pub having a pint.
If he was really cool, he'd just leave it where it was.
I'll grant you the laid-back, but I'm not completely convinced on the whole sexy part.
Those jumpers, Tim.
It's in the eye of the beholder.
Is it really? And who's in your eye, Emma?
I think, assuming that everyone that I like is cool, which is a big assumption, to start with, I'm going to pick a couple of guys who are my favourites on TV, which would be Ray Mears. Oh, I love Ray Mears. And Kevin MacLeod off Grand Designs. He knows a lot about his field as well, and he puts up with some real idiots in his line of work, and is always unfailingly polite and calm and patient with them.
Oh, I know.
Nice people. And Ray Mears, well, survival and all the rest of it.
Sexy plus laid back.
Exactly. I don't know, he's bulging out of those shorts a bit. Not in the right way.
Yeah,
no.
Okay, that's quite enough. Well, delightful as our e-hosts, Michael E. Evis and his chums are, they seem to have left us some food to eat, which is jolly decent of them. It seems to be in front of Katie, so perhaps you'd like to talk us through what we've got to chomp on, Katie.
I'm going to introduce the mock abalone, the mock chicken, and the mock duck.
So we have tin cans of mock meat.
Mock meat in a delightful blue label. They are Wu Chung brand.
So we've got abalone, which is like a sort of seafood.
Yeah.
So we are eating
the Wu Chung clam.
Hey!
Oh, dear.
We're so happy with that joke, listen.
I'm sure there'll be no more puns throughout the rest of the program.
I've actually cooked up some of the mock duck here, and I've bought some little things that we can make the little approximations of pancakes. But, I mean, if we wanted to be really daring, I could actually open one of the tins here live on air to see... what it's like in its raw state, I suppose.
Well, why don't you pass around some of this mock duck, and then maybe while we're doing that, we can open up a tin of something repulsive looking
a tin of whoop ass. Well, if I leave pancake construction to you kids, would we like chicken or abalone?
There's no difference. Look at the Dutch. Look at the Dutch for them. They're identically.
The Dutch was on the other one which I opened. Did it mean meal balls or something?
Meal balls and soy sauce. That is all they are. They're just crushed into a different shape.
The thing I love most about these mock meats is that it's just gluten, basically, and they've pressed it into shapes. But as you can see from the label on the front, they've actually kind of put fake skin on it. They've pressed it into a mould, so it looks all puckered like bird skin would.
Oh, this Dutch does actually look... quite a lot like duck.
Yes. Like meat,
but
I think
it may look quite a lot like duck, but there's another test coming along, and I have to say, my enthusiasm for this is waning as I see it in reality.
I think you're being very unfair to me. Okay. It's most appetizing.
Oh, go on. I'm going to let you guys go first.
Really?
It looks so delicious. How is it, Emma? Okay.
What's the answer to that?
Okay, well, that good, huh?
It's really like soy is the main flavour I'm getting.
I did marinate it in quite a lot of soy sauce and hyacinth sauce.
Okay, listeners, I'm going in as well, so excuse us if there is a sort of munching noise type arrangement for a couple of seconds.
You're a cartoon, Tim.
Oh, dear. You know...
Tim's verdict is...
I have a fifth sense about these things. Which I like to call taste. And it's not very pleased.
Well, wait, I've opened mock chicken now, and
this is what it looks like in its just open state. It's
it really does look like cat food.
It kind of smells like cat food too.
Cat food.
Oh, Lord. So a cat's vegetarian then?
Yes.
The combination of directional mics and directional vomiting is going to be very entertaining.
Mm. Once again, I have brought smelly things into the studio, and once again, I've disgusted everyone.
Mm. Yes. Oh.
Sorry about that. Would anyone like to try some untreated mock chicken?
Well, perhaps you could leave some.
I'm not allowed to get it near the equipment. My equipment is best.
I suppose I'm in the firing line. Come on, I've got to.
Hang on, I'll
do it. Might as well just do it with fingers. I'm sure this is making for delicious radio, but it's certainly not making for delicious. Oh my stars!
Oh, good lord!
It looks more
it's
like
huge.
Yeah, it is huge.
Maybe it's mock turkey.
I'm not looking forward to this very much, but I'm going in.
All at once as well, Brian.
Mm.
Tim's face is a rictus of horror.
Well, you know, I'm speaking with my mouth full. I like to think I'm a polite lad, but it's kind of my responsibility to speak at the moment, and my mouth is now full of genuinely repulsive mock chicken. And there it doesn't appear to be any kind of receptacle around with which, so I'm going to have to actually just swallow the stuff.
Yes, yes, you are. Well, it says here on the single ingredient on the packet is fried gluten.
Yes. Normally, fried things are nice. Normally.
But what's the liquid?
Suggest you keep your distance. My death blows inevitable, and you're susceptible to physical injury. This music industry is full of feet. That's why I'm flipping, dipping and diving. Phony executives to keep our wins consecutive. We also got a lot of actors who claim they bring the drama. The only way I'm getting laid out is with your mama commas. Couldn't stop these semicolons and hyphens when I freestyle 200 words a minute. Be typing, I'm hyping. I see the light at the end of the tunnel, like one in the chamber, ready to penetrate a stranger. I love the smell of danger. Hearing the word thoughts, and this ain't hard to figure yet. Gotta stop smoking MCs. Somebody pass me the liquor rack. Put your hands together. We about to bust your melon. Crossing the map, but shows are on a stop. Silence to stop, telling me tales your act. Ain't got no character, need more practice.
Nah, you need more stamina.
The man with the intense bow, burning up the vehicle. The battle's just me and you. Sorry, me and your crew. There's no chance of wonder when you end up getting blazed. Keep your ashes in the urn and make sure they're being saved.
I keep looking into the eyes of my enemy fortress. Snorkeling deep within the outskirts, forfeiting, calling, stalling. Falling behind a barrel in the stomach, turning or test me. Creepy crawlers, your rappers really starting to form. Forcing me to flee upon the carnage, disease. Type remedy for the ease of D, TNT. How would they be? Feed upon the energy, cause he can our seeds. It deserves a good deed for those who need intervene.
You are in the underrated subcode of a wide followers of future system with the thought that's Twitter rhyme induces. I'm moving with a band for amps and leave the afters in a brimstone. Cross kids with a bomb squad that wrecks stages and pterodones. Let it on, I've shown venomous easily, instantly, shiftily, not moving quickly enough to fade the bum rush of 14 snuff techniques specified. Grind inside, I cry with the smoke of knives and suicide. I get caught in my sick game of spy versus spy.
I drop fakers like drapes after beatdown. Defeat clowns with street sounds. Neighbors tell me to keep the heat down in this cheap town with food slip like cool chip. This ain't no school trip, it's some brew, like news clips, cruise trip, Demi Moore style, watch me rip through fakes, triple flakes, make non-believers, do the triple take, up on cruise without Tom Cruise, on the mission, my poor position, got competitions, mama wishing, they stuck to fishing by Ricky's Lake, or Rich's Bay, my woman with Billy Ocean, no, I'll be so won't get you played, by Jones Rippers, I clean clothes, lyrical mean pros, go against stream flows, hoping team knows, we get around like news vans, giving black and blues, man, so who can, touch the man with flavors like toucan.
With the mic in a spray can, I withstand any wicked plan. Conjured by a wicked man, a quicker hand to snatch up. Rhyme arson is true, spark to match up. Ciphers and flames, got nothing to lose but a whole lot to gain. So I remain the main master of ceremonial. Like Puerto Rico remains, prison by colonial. You have verses, over chakra curses, couldn't phase my basic rhyme pattern to have you all standing in the maze. I lace the track up as if it was my night.
Well, apologies for the rather swift entry into that song. I happened to fall off my seat with revulsion at the food that I was given, and I had to wash my mouth out with something tastier, which was actually a toilet duck. Katie, that was your record. What was it?
It was a song called Blaze by the Arsonists, who are obviously an hip hop group. I think the record's about 5 or 6 years old, but it's actually on Matador, and I saw them live and thought they were great. An indie hip-hop. The best kind of hip-hop.
Apart from all the other kinds. Well, thank you for that. Now, when I was a boy, My heroes were Tucker Jenkins, Billy Bremner, and the Snork Maiden, which maybe gives you a little clue into the development of my uniquely delicate sensibilities. Times change, though, and each of these figures has passed into a fond memory, one way or another. This week, the internet has been buzzing with rumours of a sexed-up treatment of Last of the Summer Wine being dreamt up by Russell T. Davis, a reinventor of Doctor Who. This isn't the first such reinvention, though, is it, Katie?
No, by no means.
Tell us more.
Well, I recently went to the cinema, as you do, to see, I think I've seen Rocky Balboa. And one of the trailers before the main event was for the new Transformers movie, which basically looks awesome. I got very, very excited and kind of looked at my boyfriend and he looked at me as if to say, there is no way we're going to see that, but we all have to go and see it because it just looks so good.
When you say we?
All of us.
All of Planet Earth.
In the name of research.
Oh, my stars.
Basically, I mean, I remember Transformers as, well, there was a cartoon on Saturday mornings, which was fairly kind of, you know, standard kiddie adventure stuff. And then, mm-hmm. of course, you had the toys, which were brilliant, and you could confuse your parents with them by just, you know, your parents never knew how they worked, and it was all a great mystery to them. And then you have this kind of, I don't know, this trailer for this film, which basically looks like the most terrifying thing ever. Because if you think about it, they're huge, enormous alien robots fighting a massive war against each other. And the trailer kind of actually gives you what that would actually be like. These machines are huge and spiky and dirty and terrifying, and they actually look like they will demolish everything in their path, whereas on the cartoon they kind of look chummy and friendly and a bit, you know, kiddie friendly.
I haven't seen this trailer, but in my mind it looks like the advertisement for that car.
Yes.
With that motor kind of scooting
but
around
a
piece
dancing.
Of ice. No dancing.
The film is directed by Michael Bay, if that gives you any clue of what it's going to be like. He directed, among other things, Bad Boys 2, which was
And Bad Boys 1.
Oh, and Bad Boys 1? Mm-hmm. I've not seen Bad Boys 1.
It's much like Bad Boys 2, as it turns out.
I had the misfortune to see Bad Boys 2. But basically, it's explosions all over the place, and
right.
It's loud, and it's basically gung-ho, full-on, it's going to knock your socks off. So I have high hopes of the Transformers movie, and it's released on July the 4th.
Kind of makes you feel warm inside, doesn't it?
Yeah, kind of. Well, it makes me feel something inside.
So are there any previous examples of this kind of reinvention of
well,
old
yeah.
stuff?
I mean, there's been lots of... Recently, I mean, to my mind, there's been a kind of spate of reimaginings of kids' classics. Like, there's been Scooby-Doo, Inspector Gadget. They've done some Dr. Seuss ones. They did The Cat in the Hat and The Grinch, which had Mike Myers and Jim Carrey in, respectively. And they're all kind of sexed up CGI. Well, I don't know if you could call Scooby-Doo sexed up.
But, well, I hope
not. Kind of
Katie,
tests.
Talk right into the mic.
Sorry.
That's a different mic from all the others, just to
okay.
trip you up.
Sorry, listeners.
I will
a
talk
small
louder.
Small technical intervention there.
Yeah, basically, kind of with the advent of CGI, they seem to be doing kind of more and more crazy, way out elaborate things. There's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie coming out soon.
Heavily trailed on the buses of London.
Yeah, but it's not Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles anymore, it's TMNT. TMNT.
Always was to the fans.
That's text speak, I think.
Well, yeah, I was a fan of the original cartoon, but I was obviously not cool enough to abbreviate it like this. But and I was thinking, they did the live-action movie of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, didn't they, a good few mm-hmm. years ago?
1988.
And obviously... Magnus.
We're also impressed by that.
by my wasted childhood.
But, I mean, obviously, kind of now, I guess the technology's come on to the point where things that would really be impossible to show before... I mean, I remember seeing trailers for the old Turtles movie. It was just four blokes in rubber suits. It looked ridiculous. And, of course, and back in my day, things like He-Man and the Care Bears that got given the movie treatment, it was just an extended cartoon. I believe they did make a He-Man movie with...
With Courtney Cox, of all people.
You are joking.
Not as He-Man, presumably.
Well, She played a local. It was a budget-saving move. They moved it from Eternia, which is where the cartoon is set, to, I believe, Los Angeles, which was probably more convenient for the Hollywood filmmakers. And one of the locals that they dragged in to sort of run around screaming as Skeletor turned up was Courtney Cox.
But she looks like Eva Lynn. Sorry, Courtney.
But one of the things that seems to be happening in a lot of these reimaginings is that they seem to be getting a little darker, more sinister. Is that fair to say, Katie?
I think so. But then again, obviously I'm having a think about this, and if you think about, as I said before, Transformers, it's a bloody terrifying concept, and I suppose
I have to say, having been of an age where I was just a little bit too old to kind of get the Transformers thing, and on those Saturday mornings I tended to have things to do, like, you know, hang around at bus stops and such, like go to record shops and so on, so I've never found the Transformers an enormously terrifying idea. They always just look like an animated version of some kids toys, which were like cars and robots as well, so I'm not overly scared by them, but I'm prepared to be convinced.
Are they being reimagined for those who were once small and who are now large?
Well, this is what I'm thinking, because obviously there's always a huge amount of nostalgia sloshing about, and you know, you obviously get people like me who go in, see the trailer for this, think, I used to love Transformers, and actually, you know, this is a real proper kind of adult take on it. I mean, I don't know, it's not certified so far, the new Transformers movie. But I would say it looked like at least a 15. It looked bloody terrifying to me.
I mean, really hoping that there's no sex.
But something like Jewel is about a big scary truck, isn't it? It's chasing someone. That's supposed to be one of the scariest films around or something.
Weirdly enough, I did see Jewel when I was about 9, and I said to my mum, this is the most boring film ever.
That's what I think too.
It's just this stupid man in a truck.
If only the truck turned into a robot.
No, that would have been great.
Exactly.
But yeah, my mum was very disappointed in my lack of imagination, I guess, as regards Jewel.
Isn't the thing that small children aren't scared of things that adults, well, and vice versa?
Exactly, because you know, if you don't understand it, I guess they will kind of be making explicit, I guess, undertones of, you know, violence and war and terrifying huge pointy machines that you just wouldn't think about when you were a kid.
Just looks like fireworks to kids, big things flashing and
exactly,
bombs going off and such.
It'll just be all big and shiny. But I mean, I guess the real test will be when the movie comes out, and I know it's actually going to be rubbish, but well, these things, you've always got high hopes, haven't you, and they always turn out.
See, I always go into these things with extremely low hopes, and I'm generally quite pleased. that's my technique.
I think that's the sensible way to go about it.
Okay, well, I have a question for you, Lollards, which is, which pieces of your childhood ephemera should be given the mecha update darkness kind of nastiness treatment?
Noggin the Nog.
Mecha Noggin the Nog with
Mecha
actual.
Mr. Ben.
Well, I'm the engine, surely, because there you've actually got a vehicle which will turn into a sheep saving robot.
No, Noggin the Nog.
One could imagine a really kind of sweaty, horrible, unwashed Noggin the Nog, where real live action Vikings go around and have big fights with like kind of rusty, horrible chainmail, and you know, it's all a bit, it's got, given some real sort of texture.
Your imagination Absolutely. Is a dark place too.
No, you know. It was like that in North London last time I went. Katie, which are you?
I was thinking about this, and like I said, they always end up disappointing. So I guess something I loved as a kid, it might get ruined. But I was, you know, something like the Moomins, maybe?
I was thinking Moomins too. I was thinking like Hattie Fatness's little kind of... Little metal monsters that like kind of like little Doctor Who silverfish that sort of went around the place and troubled people. That sounds like fun.
I reiterate Emma's point about your imagination being a dark place.
It's not my imagination, it's North London. And Emma, have you any particular favourites you'd like to see darkened? And
I think my childhood sort of filtered through the thing that filters everyone's, and you can only remember the stuff like Bagpuss and Bord and Mr. Ben. And to be honest, I can't imagine live versions of them being particularly terrifying or interesting. Maybe Tim should get on the case and write the script.
My mouth's opening and closing and no noises coming out. All of those sound fantastic.
Yeah.
King Rollo and Sister Bliss or something. And one from you, Magnus, please, before we move on.
Oh, Rent-A-Ghost, reimagined as a slasher flick.
See, that must be West London. Okay, talking of heroes and such like, last time I was here, Magnus played us the theme tune from a long-forgotten show by the name of Captain Zepp, Space Detective. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Excellent. So, more of the same this time from you, Magnus?
Absolutely. In fact, even better. Oh, do you want to know what this is?
We'll find out. A recent study by the Freaky Trigger Fictive Market Research and Trend Spotting Bureau proved, by science, that the very funniest t-shirt ever made bore the following slogan: reality is an illusion brought on by lack of alcohol. Hilarious. I'm not sure that applies. No, really. I'm not sure that applies to reality television, much of which seems to be brought on by an excess of alcohol. What's been bothering Magnus, as I understand, is what happens when it turns out that even reality television is unreal. What's troubling you, Magnus?
Well, what I was thinking about is that there's been a long tradition of satirical programmes and films and so on, which would take an established form, such as a documentary, and create something which would use a lot of the forms and the tropes of that genre, but then provide you with something which you as the audience knew was going to be satirical about it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the sort of... at the other end, and appropriate to today, there's kind of the April Fool, the joke on the audience.
Oh, you know what I said? If anyone mentioned April Fools, you know what's going to happen?
I thought you meant if anyone actually committed an April Fool.
No, I said mentioned, which means that I now owe you a pinch and a punch. Anyway, sorry.
Which will be coming.
when you least expect it.
But, it has to be on the first of the month.
They're the same month.
The month, to be fair.
But it can't be when he least expects it.
That's a fair point.
Fifth of the month. It could be the first of the tax year.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Bad form.
Well, never mind. So what I was thinking is how do these things divide? And I was also thinking there are instances which don't really sort of let on to where they fall under this. And it seems to me that the boundary between the satire of form and an outright hoax, which is really about whether to include the audience on the deception, so do they know that spaghetti doesn't really grow on trees, or that Ali G is
from there?
that Ali G is a satirical invention. And this boundary formalises where the programme makers stand in relation to the audience. And so from this, with each additional innovation to of reality to television, you can be, it seems to me, you can be increasingly equivocal about whether you're going to step over this boundary or not.
Okay.
So if you look at, I mean, the most famous example is probably War of the Worlds by the Orson Welles broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one which I'm very keen on, which was this 1992 programme called Ghostwatch, which I'll talk about later. But both of them mocked up sort of state-of-the-art reality as it was at that time, so when they were made. So for War of the Worlds, it was on-the-spot reportage, and for Ghostwatch, it was sort of live evening-long events with viewer contributions. And in both of them, they kind of deferred on deciding on whether to allow the viewers to know that it was a fabrication or not. And in the case of Ghostwatch, they pretty much abdicated their duty altogether. They sort of never really decided that they were going to tell people about this. And so for whatever reach of integrity they were shooting for, it was still sort of as a creative work rather than a joke. So they weren't trying to dupe the audience. It was almost as if they knew the audience would drift into realisation in time, but that was just part of what they were trying to do. So it wasn't as if they either wanted to play a joke on the audience or they wanted the audience to be in on it from the start. And that sort of almost didn't matter to them.
Okay.
So, I mean, the examples I'd really like to talk about, which I thought was incredibly clever when it came on out, was this one called Ghostwatch. And what Ghostwatch consisted of was a mocked-up outside broadcast unit and then a mocked-up TV studio with a telephone call centre in it. So I don't know if you remember from the late 80s and early 90s, there were a lot of sort of phone-ins and so on, which you'd see banks of telephone operators at. And they had presenters, which the audience would know. So they had Michael Parkinson chairing the whole thing. They had Mike Smith and Sarah Green as people in the outside broadcast units and manning the phones.
So these were deliberately not actors?
No, absolutely.
People who audiences knew as television presenters.
Definitely,
quite
yeah.
Specifically.
And who therefore trusted.
Absolutely, yeah.
Nobody ever trusted Mike.
And they played a trick on them. They passed this thing off, with the exception of for some rule of the BBC, they had to say written by at the beginning, but they kind of like got rid of that within half a second.
Mm-hmm.
But they passed it off as a real programme, and during the course of it, some poor family were scared witless, and they even started inserting images of ghosts into this, so that people sitting at home in their sofa would leap off their chair and go, "My God, there is actually a ghost in there," and they'd go and ring up the number, and what they'd get is a recorded message saying, "Actually, we made this all up." But if they didn't do that, there was no indication that was what had actually been done to them. And by the end of the programme, they were led to believe that by focusing on this, they'd taken part in an accidental nationwide seance. And if they were still gullible enough, they could finish the programme by believing that Sarah Green had been abducted by ghosts and that Michael Parkinson had gone mad, and that the whole country was in the grip of poltergeist-like ephemera.
One and two seem to me things I would be very comfortable with.
What sort of ghosts were they, Magnus? Were they kind of like guys in white sheets jangling chains? Or?
It was very clever. They never really showed you anything unless you were really, really looking for it. So they'd do something like and this was all pre-recorded but broadcast as if live, so they'd flash a camera across the scene of the room, and there'd be a figure in the background in the shadows, which for half a second you'd see, and then the camera would return and he wouldn't be there. So as a viewer, you might think you'd seen something which had been missed by the people who are making the programme.
Now, it seems to me that is qualitatively different from Ali G, which you brought up earlier. Mm. Now, it seems to me that the joke in Ali G, the audience are largely speaking in on the joke of
yes.
Ali G, and Ali G is in on the joke, but the joke is that the interviewees on screen are sufficiently gullible and sufficiently keen to get on the telly that they will talk to even the most idiotic. And I suppose the joke's also on television presenters because, you know, random people like whoever Ali G's interviewing, Tony Benn, actually it is plausible that somebody that stupid might be presenting a youth television programme, and therefore they have to react to those people appropriately. But that's quite different from Ghostwatch, isn't it? Where the joke's
absolutely.
On the audience.
Yeah, the joke isn't even on the audience, because I got the impression from there's been quite a lot written about this. The BBC actually pulled it. You couldn't see it for about 10 years, and then the BFI rather than BBC released a copy of it on DVD.
Because, bless the BFI.
Because the BBC were just too scared about what they'd done for one reason or another.
And they thought it was haunted, maybe.
Well, there were reports that viewers had had post-traumatic stress disorder from watching the programme.
Don't laugh.
Not laughing. I got post-traumatic stress disorder from the last time my football team was on the telly, but that's another matter.
But the commentary that came with this DVD suggested from the programme makers that they were expecting at some point the audience to work it out. And what they were kind of interested in is how long they could keep this going, and they'd be ramping up just how ridiculous it was getting. So this is why I say it was sort of like part of their creative process. They didn't really know whether they were playing a joke on the audience or whether they were trying to bring them in. And by the end, I mean, when you watch it now, even though you know it's completely made up, it's still a frightening programme in the same way that watching, say, a horror film can be frightening, because it's full of stuff that scares you.
Oh, that's sort of frightening. Yeah, I've heard of that.
It seems that what they did as well was... They'd not only kind of left the kind of I can't think of the word, but they actually left the audience to make the scary bits up themselves. So what people were scared of was not actually anything that was on the TV at all. It was what they made of the dark shadow. So, you know, it was completely created by the audience in that sense.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was very interactive at a time when people weren't used to being interactive with the media that they received. I thought it was incredibly innovative. But I also think that there's an effect of programmes like this, and I haven't really found one which sort of goes all the way in the way that Ghostwatch did, which is that they can only happen very occasionally, because if they happen but too frequently, then people either get wise to them or the power dissipates.
Right.
Or it's, and also, I'd imagine, you can't really sell the hook very much. I mean, if you're doing a reality TV programme, then if the whole point of it is something you can't tell the audience about, how do you market it?
Well, and Ghostwatch in particular is playing on the fact that when we watch TV and films, we some of us suspend our disbelief, and so that's what it's doing. It's actually it's deliberately going into that space and working out where the limits of our disbelief suspension are. But does that mean do you think that broadcasters and program makers have a duty of care to take a bit of care about that, because actually when your disbelief is suspended, you believe stuff, and therefore you're in a relatively vulnerable state?
Well, I certainly think that the senior people in program making do, and with both War of the Worlds and Ghostwatch and a lot of other examples, it seems that the mechanisms which deliver these things, like you are obliged to give a cast list and so on, they don't allow those to be buried. So I think some senior bod in the BBC decided, we've got to say that this is fictional in the Radio Times, we've got to put a writer's credit up. So it seems that yes, there is a duty of care as acknowledged by the responsible folk, but those irresponsible people who just want to have fun and play with the audience and so on,
those accursed creators,
yes, yeah, will try and take as many liberties as they can if they're trying to do this sort of thing.
Fair play.
And they did a similar sort of thing, it seems to be, with the Blair Witch Project, with all the marketing leading up to it. It was saying, yeah, this is footage that was actually found. And I did watch it, and I don't know, I just thought it was a bit rubbish. Really.
What, quite amateurish?
Yeah, well, yeah.
But, you know, how credulous are people? How stupid are people?
Again,
you've got to wonder.
But
not you, Katie. Sorry.
Thanks so much.
Fight in the corner here. That's great.
I just saw it on the telly, but maybe if you were in the cinema and you kind of have that immersive experience where you're in, you know, and it's all dark and you do suspend your disbelief, because if I'm in the cinema, I will pretty much, hence being completely captivated by the Transformers. Like,
they're not real.
But, what?
Don't tell her that.
But with the Blair Witch Project, one of the problems the actors had is that so many people thought it was real that they weren't getting offers of other work, because apparently...
Everyone thought they were dead.
Yes.
Oh, that's a shame.
I can't remember seeing the credits of it, but I mean, it must have had credits rolling at the end, like a film.
But yeah, they used their own names even in the film, so the credits would just say, you know, these were the actors you saw. these are the people you saw.
Blimey.
It tried the same thing that you were talking about before, Casey, didn't it? It didn't actually show any of the really scary stuff, apart from a guy standing in the corner in a basement.
Yeah, and I guess what,
no, it sometimes is scary, but not in this instance,
so,
I found.
So the people who imagined that the most horrible things had happened to them were the people who were most scared by it.
Right.
So...
bad business. Well, happily, Freaky Trigger doesn't consider ourselves to have a duty of care in the making of this making of this broadcast, so we're just going to carry on regardless. And now, talking of duties of non-care, it's time for another piece of careful musicology, courtesy of the exquisite sensibilities of our conservatory-trained music critic, Tanya Hedden. Tanya, ask...
Charles, who China Crisis apparently believe in. Now, Ray Charles's blackness is not a secret, so why did China Crisis see fit to remind us of it on their incomprehensibly awful single? My theories. One, the song was meant to be a double A-side with White Man Ray about snooker ace Ray Reardon, but it was dropped when China Crisis decided they preferred Dennis Taylor and his clever upside-down glasses. Two, it's not about Ray Charles, but photographer Man Ray and asserting he was black, which he wasn't. But this was the 80s and all sorts of people were black back then. Shakespeare, Mariah Carey, Ireland, Californian raisins. Three, it was a reference to the much-rumoured secret weapon of the South African apartheid regime, the Black Man Ray. Fashioned from Nazi technology, this weapon was supposedly able to fire into a crowd of people of various ethnicities and just pick out those of African origin. China Crisis, not content to constantly remind the world of the crisis in China, were also warning the world of a great evil in Africa. However, the real reason I have uncovered was symptomatic of the stupidity of this gas band. What with Ray Charles being blind, the lads from China Crisis thought he might not know he was black. Therefore, they wrote this song to remind him. They thought it would help him understand some of the discrimination he would have put up with in his youth, maybe explain why he was drawn to playing in certain kinds of clubs, hence Black Man Ray. There was a precedent. The Beatles did a similar thing when they wrote Lady Madonna. You'd think someone, like Ray's parents, might have told him he was black. It was nice of China Crisis to be so thoughtful. Of course, if they'd been really thoughtful, they would have just rung him up and told him, rather than recording a plodding ballad about it. I'm Tanya Hedden, and I hate music.
Thanks, Tanya. One of the more famous punk rock pseudonyms was Captain Sensible, bassist and then guitarist out of the Damned. I always reckoned that he missed a trick because his real name was Ray Burns, and it had a definite sort of science fiction reference possibility. You know, it could have been, you know, what you get off a laser held by a horrible, unfriendly transformer, for example, if transformers had existed in 1976. Anyway, the other bad thing, of course, was Ray Burns' little sisters were called Carpet and Side, respectively. So this naming game is a potential minefield, isn't it, Emma?
Absolutely, and me and my dear husband are about to have to go through this in about 4.5 months when our little bundle of joy turns up. And obviously my mind's been playing on this particular subject and thinking that parents have a huge responsibility. I mean, not only are we handing on our genes to the poor little thing, the little darling, we've also got to think of a name that's going to stick with this little child for, what, 70, 80 years? And that's going to not lead him to be mercilessly teased or bullied in any way, either as a child or in later life. So it's a bit of a responsibility, and it's been left in the hands of a frankly extremely hormonal woman. I mean, you know, we're talking about women who eat sand, not me personally. Many pregnant women have been known to do this.
Sand would be preferable to mock chicken.
It's a better name.
It's women who eat sand and mock chicken. I mean, an internet mums-to-be forum that I'm on, one of the ladies there started a poll to find out which of the following names she should choose for her son to be. And the options she offered were Kester, Blaze, Pavel and Ivor. Not the engine. But I mean, obviously this woman's in the grip of some kind of dementia, but to be fair, I don't think that an unusual name is the worst thing you can inflict on a child. In fact, it can be quite cool, and a lot of people who have unusual names quite like them, but there are some names that are cruel. I'm thinking especially things that, when teamed with your surname, creates something hilarious, such as examples I've heard of were sort of Mr. and Mrs. Forrest, who call their child Rain. oops, let's hope that little girl manages to get married to someone who's not called, I don't know, well, Kevin MacLeod, for example. That would be unfortunate. Someone told me of Mr. and Mrs. Kermode, who called their daughter Honour.
That cannot possibly be true, but I hope it is.
I'd like to think it was true. I mean, our baby's surname is going to be quite unusual, so I don't think we've got any limitations on that one. But, I mean, other things that seem to be quite cruel are, I don't know, calling a boy a girl's name, like Hillary, for example.
I'm continually perplexed when I meet men called Hillary.
Does it happen often?
I've known two or three Hillaries through the course of my lengthy lifetime, and I always... Actually, they've all been really nice, and so I haven't wanted to laugh in their faces. But I have always, at the back of my head, when I've been introduced, thought, ha-ha.
You're called Hillary. Exactly. And I'm sure, Tim's a very nice man. I'm sure not everyone out there is going to be as kind to a boy called Hillary.
No. And I must say, I was an adult by the time I met these so-called Hillaries.
There you go.
The wrestler Big Daddy was called Shirley, which is presumably why... He became a big, bulky wrestler.
And Ice-T, famously, is called Tracy something or other, isn't he? Which is presumably why he carries a great big gun around with him.
So I was assuming that's what the poor guy's parents did to him. I don't want our little one to be running around with a gun.
Well, both of those, I think they negotiated the problem quite well, because they turned their playground warfare into a lucrative relatively harmless career.
Indeed.
It's true,
yes, but you can't really guarantee that, can you? I mean, your child might be born with no talent and have a stupid name. In which case you really...
You mustn't call him talentless.
You can choose. You can't choose the genes, but you can choose the name, so you've got to be careful there. I mean, I think you look at famous people, and they presumably think that the genes they're handing down have some degree of talent, which is why you end up with the likes of, you know, Zowie Bowie and...
Julian Lennon.
Yeah, he was on my list. I think the worst celebrity name I've heard recently is the appallingly spoonerizable... Is that a word?
Yeah.
So the appallingly spoonerizable Shiloh Pitt, who... it's not a joke. I mean, obviously, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are handing down some fairly beautiful genes to their little girl. And they've obviously decided that she can't sail through life unencumbered by trauma. So the child is called Shiloh Pitt.
I have to confess, I hadn't heard that before, and I'm delighted. I couldn't be more pleased.
Yeah, I think it kind of whoops Bluebell Madonna, which is Jerry Halliwell's little girl, into a name cocked hat.
Moobel Bladonna, no,
it doesn't work, does it? No. But you expect that sort of behaviour from celebrities, really, don't you?
I suppose so. They're a law unto themselves.
They are. They're a funny bunch.
And I mean, the other problem that can come up in this particular minefield, it seems to me, is that you call your child a particularly ordinary name,
yes,
entirely unremarkable, and then fate takes a hand.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure there are an awful lot of Phil Collinses out there who have never been involved with Genesis in any way, shape, or form.
Queuing up outside the deed poll office.
But that's the thing, these are really ordinary names, and you just don't know. I mean, we could call our child something perfectly innocuous, and then in 20 years' time, I don't know, a serial killer, or someone like Phil Collins, who's not a serial killer, that I know of, yes, as far as we know, could turn
serial
out to have the same
killer
name. And then, you know, the poor person, adult, whatever, is going to be...
Right. I know a fellow who's in his early 50s. He's a delightful man, friend and colleague, and he, I suppose, in the late 1950s in the UK, he was named Richard Nixon. I know, and I imagine at that point it would have taken an acute observer of American politics to have even heard the name of Senator Richard Nixon at that point. And, you know, by the time he was in his teenage years in the 1970s, I suppose, He shared a name with, I guess, one of the most hated men on the planet.
I wonder if there's many Margaret Thatchers out there, actually.
I did know a Margaret Thatcher once.
Get out.
I did. And she introduced herself as Diane. Because when Margaret Thatcher came to prominence, she couldn't bear to be associated with same. So she was married, so she married into the name Margaret Thatcher and changed her married name to Diane.
Well, you see, there's another problem. I mean, if you have a daughter and she decides to change her name when she gets married, then, you know, you could end up with, I've heard all sorts of, Beverly Smith marrying Mr. Weatherly and turning into Beverly Weatherly. And this is like the sort of famous name of becoming famous later in life. You just can't plan ahead for that sort of thing, unfortunately.
Surely Beverly Smith might notice when she's going out with Mr. Weatherly.
Yeah, but
she's in love with the guy. Come on, give Paul Bev a break.
I mean, Jerry Hall and Brian Ferry never got married, but if you'd have had Jerry Ferry.
The problem is really this silly habit of having two bits to your name, which aren't controlled at the same point of choice, are they?
Good point, yes.
I think numbers is the way to go, and just be very strict on not having the stupid ones. So obviously 7 of 9 is 5, fine. But 5 of 11 would be really, really crap.
once again, my mouth is opening and closing. Very little noise is coming out as the depth of the working of Mark Sinker's mind begin to be exposed.
It just makes me think of people who kind of theme their names and, I don't know, call their children the days of the week or something.
Everyone in West Ham football team at the time.
Yeah,
Tuesday is a really nice name.
Yes.
But not if Thursday, you also have children called Monday and Wednesday.
I had a friend at school whose parents were kind of on the periphery of celebrity life, but they weren't certain that their son was going to be a celebrity himself. So this guy, whose name was Richard Nathan, was given a completely separate middle two names of Sammy Starr, just in case he needed them later on.
Richard Sammy Starr Nathan?
Yes.
Oh, bless. How considerate is that? That's fantastic.
Well, it's more considerate than Mr. and Mrs. Neville calling their son Neville, isn't it?
That's true.
Yes.
Oh, it seems to me the least explicable of the whole lot. Mm-hmm. You know, your name is Neville. Why would you call your son Neville Neville? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it's the women eating sand thing. I mean, you know, I don't want to start moaning on there, but, you know, pregnancy's not that much fun, and maybe the woman just thinks, you know, I've just been through labour. How do I get my own back on this one?
Well, that maternal care.
I've spoken the unsayable or something. Yeah. Sorry, everyone.
Katie, you meet lots of rock and roll types. Have you ever come across anyone with spectacularly dumb names?
Well, not really. I mean, there was a... not a rock and roll type, but in my school we had an honours board, and one of the women, kind of names of the girls who'd gone to my school and presumably gone on and been nurses in the war and stuff, and one of these women was called Ina Bucket, which we just used to congregate around and giggle as we were queuing up for assembly. And
but again, Ina, Ivor and Ida are all really dangerous names.
She was right. On the honours board, so presumably it had spurred her on to at least...
Well,
I may have a silly name, but at least it will be associated with achievement and greatness.
Well, I suppose so.
Maybe she just wanted to go into the army to meet a soldier who has a sensible surname.
Yeah, but, you know, like she met Mr. Tent or Mr. anything, really. Her first name's Ina. And yeah, as Magnus said, yeah, Ida, especially.
Mm. And Ivor.
And Ivor.
Yeah. Mm.
Yes.
Ivor Biggin.
Yeah, I don't think there are many people out there.
I don't think that Biggin was a real name.
There must be.
Once again, my dearly held illusions lie shattered and broken on the floor. It's most upsetting. You're saying Ivor Biggin wasn't a real person?
No, it wasn't a real name. He was a real person.
but he was a real person with actually another false name, wasn't he?
Because
he
was 3 of 6.
Wasn't his real? Wasn't that Doc Cox? Doc Cox off TV's That's Life. His stage name was Ivor Biggin, but I don't suppose he was christened Doc either. He might have been.
So, do you think you're allowed to give people names that could mislead the public in terms of...
What, my son Professor?
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's Earl, isn't it?
Well, then you are Prince, Heinz.
Michael Jackson's kid's called Prince Michael. I mean, do you think that's going to fool anybody?
not the parents of the actual Prince Michael.
No, that's right. He wasn't born in Kent, so everyone's okay in this regard. So, do any of you have any complaints, and I have to say I am looking at one member of the team in particular with the name that you were given at birth.
I have a mildly famous name that's only just famous enough to occasionally cause problems, being named after Nelson's mistress and sort of famous 18th century slapper Emma Hamilton. But I actually really like it. It's not quite famous enough that everyone I meet passes comment, but I mean, I didn't change it when I got married, so I must like it some. Sorry, Alan, by the way.
It does give you the distinct advantage of having an actual real pub actually really named after you.
No, I've never been there. All my friends used to want me to go down there and demand loads of free drinks, but right. I'm yet to try that one.
A friend of mine whose surname was Fitchett, we once took him to the pub in Rotherhithe called The Fitchetts and demanded free drinks, and it didn't work.
Oh, well, I won't bother then.
It was a complete failure. Strangely, pubs don't seem to like giving away drinks for free.
Yes.
My own personal complaint is with a name that I wasn't actually given, which is the name Tom, and through some strange combination of circumstances, I seem to get called Tom about once a fortnight by all manner of different people. I get emailed with the name Tom. There's another guy in the same firm that I work for who's called Tom Hopkins, who gets lots and lots of my mail. It's all very, very confusing and, frankly, a bit upsetting. And the funny thing about it is that I was going to be called Tom, but my folks were overruled by my then 4-year-old brother.
It just shows what he knows, eh?
I know. Hey, well, in a sense, he probably did me a favour. Mm. Anyway, it's probably time for a bit more music. And Emma, you have a song for us, I hope.
Yes.
What is it?
It's ABBA, Name of the Game, because it's got the word name in the title.
Good choice.
Thank you.
So, once again, we're near the end of our show. Stay tuned for the Other Woman, all-female playlist selected by Ruth Barnes, followed by Calling All Pensioners and the Rocket 88 Doo-Wop Rock and Roll Show, which begins at 3. All that remains to do is to announce the new Shock Worldwide number one, according to charts compiled by the Freaky Trigger Fictive Market Research and Trend Spotting Bureau, which I may have mentioned before. This week, we've been surprised, and I have to say delighted, to learn that number one is actually Take Back Your Duck by The Inspirations, and here it is. Oh, well, apparently here it is, although
maybe they took it back.
Dread at the controls is having a little bit of problem operating the sticky CD player, so we're just looking at him at the moment and laughing.
It's not going to play.
It's not going to play.
I don't know what, it's just... It Q is flashing at me.
So press play on the CD player.
Not happening.
Oh, it's a lovely record.
No, it's not. It's not coming up properly on the display.
Can we sing it?
We, i.e. me.
Yes, you too.
I don't think I can sing it. No, it's a delightful song. Mark's desperately pressing buttons.
No, it's not going to work. Sorry.
I'm very sorry. You're going to have to miss out. Well, you've all downloaded it illegally anyway. So it falls to me, in conditions of silence, sadly, to announce that you've been listening to Emma Hamilton, Katie Grokert and Magnus Andersson. Your producer / knobsman this week was Mark Sinker. And
I did a terrible job, I'm afraid.
You did a delightful job. And my name's Tim Hopkins. happily, not Tom Hopkins. Take note, everyone in the world. You can find us, among others, on one of the internets at freakytrigger.co.uk. Oh, maybe you already have. Today's show was brought to you by the word mock. As Mikey Dread once said, see you all and have a ball. Keep the faith and spread it. Gently.